From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. It's been an intense week. So glad you're there. We have Congressman John James, who wants to be governor of Michigan. He's going to be with us bottom of the hour, veteran. And Rebecca Heinrichs in studio, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. And we're covering all the breaking news, and we should be getting news within our show on the latest with Iran and will the president be heading there. We'll be discussing that and getting, of course, your calls. So before we get to Rebecca, let's get to the big three.
Number three. They just literally disappeared, left all of their devices at home. This is not normal. These are some of the most advanced scientists, researchers, some of the most important people for nation's national security efforts, and they all just mysteriously disappeared.
There you go. This is really crazy. Congressman Eric Burleson, who is just on with me, where do they go? 12 missing scientists have either died or been murdered or just flat out disappeared. Is this all unrelated? They all have very similar backgrounds, nuclear backgrounds, science backgrounds, space backgrounds. No one knows. We will investigate.
Number two.
The entire mission was one profound experience after another.
But when you see it against the blackness of the universe, you recognize that it's not an absolute. It's something to love and that unites us.
That's going to be important because Artemis II is super challenging. It gets a lot harder from here.
Artemis II, crew speaks. This remarkable crew and details on the missions to follow. We'll discuss it all.
Number one.
Iran wants to make a deal, and we're dealing very nicely with them. We've got to have no nuclear weapons. If we do, that's a big factor. And they're willing to do things today that they weren't willing to do 2 months ago.
And the president of the United States said he lost his voice screaming at the Iranians on the phone. Almost over. President's blockade, he believes, has broken Iran to the point that a deal can get done. I have my doubts, not about the blockade, but about the Iranians willing to capitulate. What does Rebecca Heinrichs think? Let's ask her. Hey, Rebecca, great to see you.
Hey, good to be here.
All right. So your thoughts about the president's optimism?
So this is really common for President Trump. When he's negotiating, he almost kind of tries to will things in the direction he wants it to go. So
his, his public comments are part of the negotiation.
His public comments are always part of the negotiation. So I think that he's trying to demonstrate, I'm pushing it in this in the right direction. I want some momentum in this direction. And the president really has on the ground sort of concretely the advantage. He's got military forces in the region. He hasn't taken a single troop out of the region. We're actually surging
6,000 more.
More. We've got more. And these are forces that have specializations for in case we do some kind of raid inside the country. So incredible naval blockade that are still in place. Very successful. So the president has, you know, a lot of advantage here. He's just trying to squeeze the Iranians to get them where he wants them.
So Jack Keane thinks they have, we should go for absolutely everything, that the Iranians have no cards. Here's what he just told me on Fox and Friends. Cut eight.
These are less about negotiations in my mind. I know why we want to use that term, but it's more about putting our terms on the table and you take it or leave it.
Absolutely.
And that is the attitude we should have in dealing with these people. There's no face saving here. This, we're asking them to do, to surrender everything that we want without signing a surrender document. That's the face saving aspect of this. They give us everything that we want, and we've listed all of those.
Are you as optimistic and as definitive as the general?
Yeah, no, I think that the general is right that essentially we're giving the Iranians an ultimatum. You can do it the hard way or the harder way. You can either give us this opportunity to remove the nuclear material, get some international, you know, operation in there to remove it and stand by and let us do that safely, or we're going to do it forcibly. We're going to do it militarily. And we want you to basically surrender the strait. I mean, we're not going to allow, when this thing is over, the Iranians are not going to resume threatening the strait and having control. There's going to be no toll booth over the Strait of Hormuz run by the Iranians. We talked about this before. The Iranian oil goes to China. So it's essentially default surrendering the strait to China if we were to do that. So I think that General Keane is right. You know, that we have all of the advantage at this point. There's no reason for President Trump to make any kind of capitulation for the Iranian side at all.
The blockade was brilliant.
Yeah.
So we were talking about they have the strait. What are we going to do? Gas prices are going up. No oil's in. They'll decide who gets in and out. To the blockade's done. We surrounded their blockade was surrounded by our blockade. And then we've stopped 14 ships from going out. And Iran right now is essentially a week away from maximizing all their oil storage.
Well, the other thing that I think is really incredible about this is you could see the Trump administration getting the U.S. in a really good position economically and from an energy perspective, even before we launched Epic Fury. So we made sure that, you know, the president was, you know, we had plenty of oil on our side. We were looking at ways to get more oil flowing. We're in a good place economically. And then launches Epic Fury, then clears the strait, essentially takes out most of Iran's capabilities to threaten the strait. And then we've got naval forces in there. So they're safely operating in there. And by the way, we've talked about this too. Now is the time for an international armada. The United States Navy has demonstrated the strait is safe for those who are traversing through there as long as you're not stopping in Iranian ports.
So I want you to, so I just want to try to get the other perspective and find out what Iran's saying. And we'll find out, you know, what they say and the amount of leverage they have. Not much leverage, but they say this. The United States, we will stop enriching to a certain point for 3 to 5 years. We'll take the uranium that we have and we'll down blend it, but we're not giving it up. We want all the sanctions relieved and released. And you can use the strait, but on the Oman side, not our side.
No,
I'm just giving you the idea. And of course, Trump's not going to accept any of that.
No. Again, and on that last point, again, that's still putting conditions on the strait. We cannot accept any kind of Iranian conditions on the strait. On the downblending, I mean, anything having to do with the uranium. I mean, look, part of President Trump's rightful frustration with the ridiculous Obama-Iran deal was these sunset provisions, that just after a few years that we would relieve these conditions and that there would be sanctions relief. So that's sort of a version of the Obama deal that President Trump has rightfully rejected. Diplomacy in any way that forces the United States to trust what the Iranians have said has failed, which is why we're in the position we are now. And President Trump, again, the Iranians don't have any leverage over the United States right now to extract that kind of capitulation. I do not expect President Trump to do that.
So we're seeing the foreign minister say that the Strait of Hormuz is completely open. So that's why maybe I'm trying to find the story, Pete. If we can look for it, I know you've got your hands full, but the market is at 49,000 plus and up 600 points, and I'm thinking that's got to be the reason. I mean, that's also a play. If you stop that ceasefire, because we haven't discussed this yet, but yesterday the president got the prime minister Netanyahu and the Lebanese leader to agree to a ceasefire that would include Hezbollah, although we're getting reports that some fighting's happening.
Yeah.
Well, that was one thing that Iran asked for, because Hezbollah is solely controlled by Iran.
It is. I would also just note, even on that point, though, that even according to the statement released about the conditions of that regarding Hezbollah, that President Trump has made it clear that Israel has a right to defend itself. So we should not sort of think that that Israel is being restrained in some way by the United States from defending itself if Hezbollah continues its attacks, which I would expect it to.
So this is the story, Rebecca. We're talking with Rebecca Heinrichs here from the Hudson Institute. This is the story that we're seeing now that's put out on Twitter, on X. In line with the ceasefire in Lebanon, the passage for all commercial vessels through the Strait of Hormuz is declared completely open for the remaining period of the ceasefire on the coordinated route as already announced by Ports and Maritime Organization of Iran. Number one, it sounds like they're in control, which is a problem. It's international waters. They're not in control. But if you need 100 plus ships going through there, there's between 500 and 800 tankers. I know we're not maritime experts, but do you send them through on that note?
Yeah, I mean, I would send them through. I would send them through.
We have to let them through,
but I would be clear, though. I wouldn't send them through because I'm comfortable with anything that the Iranians say. I mean, I don't trust the Iranians. But you have so much American naval power in the region enforcing this. And if you have any of these sort of militia guys on the Iranian side begin attacking again, I mean, that would be so unbelievably foolish. And the United States would then, you know, take out those individuals who are threatening the strait. From the beginning, what I continue...
Can I just stop you one thing?
Yeah.
Do you believe the foreign minister speaks for the IRGC.
Yeah, it's from the IRGC, and there's this...
Do you think there's a difference?
I think that
there... Yeah,
I think that there's... I think that there's a difference. I think what he's trying to communicate is, to your point, you've already implied, that he has control, that it's up to him, that he's controlling the strait. And so he is the one that has to bless it or not, which, of course, is not true. But he is... There's been a breakdown in command and control. We're not quite sure how this rump regime is able to communicate directly to these militias along the coast. So if you just have this broad announcement in some fashion, then he may be telegraphing to them, don't fire on these ships that might be traversing.
But I also believe the story, because it makes sense, that we don't know exactly where we put the mines. You know, so that's why we sent the destroyer through, I think it was a destroyer, too. While the negotiations were going on with J.D. Vance, I love that we send those two ships through the strait. Didn't ask no one's permission, and they were sweeping to try to find mines. Evidently, there we have drones that go search for mines, which is pretty amazing. They go search for mines, and we found nothing. But bottom line is, if Iran says we dropped them, but we don't know where we put them, I don't know if I believe that story. And if I do believe that story, why would I send my tanker through there?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, this goes back to... Whenever we say that Iran has closed the strait, what we really mean is they've de facto closed the strait because they're terrorizing the strait. We don't actually
They don't have a navy.
They never really did have the ability to physically, you know, enforce a blockade the way the United States Navy is. It's just that they have the ability, so they can just say there may be mines. We may have dropped mines. I don't know where they are, and that scares a lot of people. But if you have the U.S. Navy doing sweeping with these underwater, you know, mine surveillance apparatus to go find these drones or find these mines, and then we say they're removed, or we get Europeans are really good at minesweeping, actually. If we say, look, we found two here, three here, come get them, you got to get traffic then operating through there. I mean, there's no other way to do it.
What is your reaction to 40 nations getting together, led by France and England, to talk about policing the strait after we're done without us?
Yeah, so I think that, look... I understand that Transatlantic Alliance has been really bumpy for the last year plus, but really has gotten really bumpy. But we're to the point now where we say, listen, guys, I understand that you're frustrated for the following reasons. You were not consulted before the United States launched this military operation. I get it. I thought the threats to Greenland were a major problem. We're going to have material impact on the alliance. Having said that, enough. I mean, if you come in and start, you know, just securing the strait after the military operation is over, it's like, what are you doing? So I think we have got to get to a place where these countries just say, we are going to go in there. We're going to help the United States do this. And by the way, the more countries, the more flagged ships you have operating in there, the less of a risk there is. The Iran can't just shoot at 35 different flagged ships, you know, different countries. It puts them in an impossible position. So we really do need the help now. I think it would be great to get that, you know, traffic
escorts,
open quickly.
For the escorts.
Absolutely.
In the beginning.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, we're seeing these stories, and I watch in the morning because we have so many repeats. I'm here at like 3:45 in the morning. So I'm watching Sky and I'm watching the BBC. They're embarrassed and almost kept in the dark on how bad their navy, what bad off their navy is. And the fact is that they had to borrow a German ship in order to help out to begin with, has embarrassed the entire United Kingdom. So you could act tough and your feelings could be hurt. You can't exist without the United States. There is no NATO without us. There's no NATO to be feared without us.
No, that's exactly right. And look, I've talked to some folks inside the administration too. And at this point, they've said, we're not even beating up on these countries at this point for their lack of military capacity. We just need them to bring something, contribute something. The more, if you have a ship, if you have some minesweeping capability, if you have some ability to conduct surveillance, we just need whatever you can bring. If you want to do electronic warfare and cyber stuff, whatever capability you have, bring it to the strait so that we can put it to use, you know?
Right.
And I mean, that's what we need at this point.
So Rebecca, the other thing that everyone's got to learn from Saudi Arabia, they say through their pipeline and using the Red Sea has now backed down to the level that they were before the strait was shut down, before the war. Everyone has to reconsider, unless till that Iran regime changes, everyone has to reconsider using the strait. And I think all these Arab nations can no longer be the bankers for Iran. They, all these Gulf states, they got to stop with the money, you know, the wink and the nod, changing in dollars and storing their money. That's all got to stop. And they, everyone's got to think of an alternative to the Strait of Hormuz. We did.
Yeah. No, we did. And the other thing that they got to do is they just, this sort of, and I do think that this has begun to change, this kind of public denunciation of the Israelis and then privately kind of giving a wink and a nod to the United States and Israel. Please do handle, please help us handle the Houthis. Please, you know, please, you know, take out all of these other Iranian proxies. Publicly, you need the Gulf states to now communicate. The United States and Israel, frankly, they've been, we've been forces for good for them in the region for stability. And I do think, you know, we already had the Abraham Accords. I have viewed Epic Fury as basically the military manifestation of the Abraham Accords. You've got these Gulf partners now working with the United States and Israel. The fact that you've got the Israelis even going into these Gulf states and helping them with air defense is incredible. It's incredible.
Rebecca, what are you doing now? Are you going on TV after this?
Yeah, got some stuff lined up.
I thought so. Rebecca Heinrich, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. Thanks so much. We're riding with the breaking news. Bottom line is, the market is very encouraged. We're getting close to 50,000 again. We might even cross that threshold again. The market's up substantially. And when the market goes up, when this thing's over, if it's, especially if it's ended the right way, every day the story is going to be gas and oil going down. You know why? Because we don't need to we don't need to drain the oil reserves. We don't need to ask Venezuela to get their bad oil from a corrupt dictator. We are doing it ourselves, and Venezuela is no longer an enemy. So anybody trying to make a political hay over the price of gas, just know it's not going to be working for you shortly, should this thing come to an end. Rebecca, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, so we went with a little long with Rebecca Heinrich, so it'll be a short segment. Bottom of the hour, though, we'll continue to talk. This with Congressman John James, who's a veteran, went to West Point, and he is a congressman now, and he wants to be the next governor. But yesterday, just real quick on the special election, really discouraging for New Jersey, I believe, because New Jersey has a lot of conservatives there, and I think it's, I guess it's like 54, 44, something to that nature. They'll put a Republican in there if he or she is good. Tom Malinowski was looked at as somewhat of a moderate in that district, and before in the past, Republicans have won that district. Mikey Sherrill flips the seat. And then the far leftist, this Mejia, who is to the left of the squad, wins substantially. The polls closed at 8 o'clock. 8:07, they declared her the winner. So that, to me, is discouraging. And I'll tell you, Republicans who want to get some momentum going, and they can, as we watch the market at 49,326, up 554 points already. We'll see what happens. If the president gets on that plane to Pakistan, that means a deal. I'm going to tell you what a good deal will look like. I think you know, but it's got to be a complete KO. Complete KO. And every single member of the media, if that does happen, almost, I would say 97% will owe Trump an apology.
Listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey everyone, so I'm here in Charlotte. Since the start of Trump's war of choice, it's $15 more every time you fill up your tank of gas. The price of diesel has now gone up 80% since the start of the war. And you best believe that's going to carry over to how much you're paying for all the goods that are being transported on those semis. We've got a president who is paying more attention to what he thinks is in his best political interest and personal interest as opposed to what is in the best interest of working people in America.
So is she out of her mind? I mean, this is a vice president, Kamala Harris, obviously, who, when asked about the price of gas, says, well, sometimes you got to do things for national security. Remember the Putin price hike? You know what it was? It was her refusal to drill and shutting off, by the way, the president didn't even know it, Biden at the time, shut off natural gas production, basically, and destroying any shot of winning Pennsylvania for Kamala Harris. Didn't even know it. So his people did. And we were buying dirty oil from Venezuela. and we were draining our strategic oil reserves to keep oil down. If the president cared about his political interest, he never would have done Iran, ever. He would have just said, well, you know, we blew it up in 2025 and we watched as they started pulling out the uranium and rebuilding their weapons program and continued to reconstitute their missile program. But instead, he did something politically perilous because he saw 41,000 people killed and he saw a renegade regime rebuilding their nuclear program. So she's in front of $4.06 gas and diesel is high. But there's a reason why the market is up 700 points and now at 49,000. And this is what the president just put on Truth Social before I break and bring in my next guest. First, he put up, I don't know when, doesn't have a timestamp on it, but first he writes, Iran has just announced the Strait of Iran is the Strait of Iran, he should have said Hormuz, is fully open and ready for full passage. Minutes later, he writes, the strait is completely open and ready for business in full passage, but the naval blockade will remain in full force and effect as it pertains to Iran only until such time as our transaction with Iran is 100% complete. The process should go quickly, and the most of the points are already negotiated. Thank you for your attention to this matter. Let's bring in Congressman John James, Energy and Commerce Committee, former combat helicopter pilot who flew in Iraq, also graduated from West Point, wants to be the next governor of Michigan. Congressman, welcome back.
Hey, Brian, thanks for having me back on.
First off, what's your instant reaction to this movement in these negotiations?
My first reaction is President Trump is the only one who could have possibly made this happen. How do we go in less than 2 weeks from Iran refusing to negotiate to the Strait of Hormuz all of a sudden being open? This would only be possible under President Trump. The people around the world, allies and adversaries, both know that when the president speaks, he means what he says. President Trump is a president of peace, and he delivers on his promises. Right now, it's absolutely insane to hear Kamala Harris talk about her revisionist history when it's Democrats. It was Obama and Biden who flew a pallet of billions of dollars over to the Iranians that John Kerry later acknowledged was making it into the hands of their terrorist proxies. It was the Obama administration that negotiated that Iran nuclear deal that allowed them to enrich uranium to get to this point. Everything that President Trump and Republicans are doing are to fix the mistakes that happened under the Obama-Biden administration and were exacerbated under Biden-Harris.
So,
Trump is bringing us back, and the only reason that they can talk about oil and gas prices is because President Trump focused on energy dominance and brought oil and gas prices down. You're absolutely right, Brian. President Trump is doing this not in his own best interest, but in the interest of the United States of America.
Believe me, politically, yeah, I mean, a lot of Republicans are mad at him. There's that whole extreme right, which I have very little use for. Conservatives, they're ripping them. Oh, we're supposed to be America first, no more foreign wars. Well, there was a time in which it's in our interest to have a foreign policy, too. I thought people realized that. But I want you just to finish off the Kamala Harris point. Let's go back to 2022. Cut 11.
When America stands for her principles and all of the things that we hold dear, it requires sometimes for us to put ourselves out there in a way that maybe we will incur some cost. And in this situation, that may relate to energy costs.
The president did say in the State of the Union, there is a price to pay for democracy. You've got to stand with your friends. Sometimes it's difficult. Often it ain't easy.
So we're standing up to one of our enemies. With in Iran, 41,000, between 30 and 41,000 killed in cold blood for wanting things like water and freedom for women to be able to get the headgear off them and be able to live a normal life. So we watch that happen. I know it doesn't work into our foreign policy interest to say regime change, but we got to get that new government in there. But it's just amazing to me. I'm all for Ukraine, by the way. I know that goes against a lot of Republicans. I want Ukraine to be successful. But it's amazing to me that it's okay to defend Ukraine, but it's not okay to take on one of our enemies.
Well, Democrats are completely untethered from reality. You don't have to go back any farther just 2 years ago to literally see them completely contradicting themselves. I mean, everything from the border, when you have Bernie Sanders saying that we need to make sure that we don't have illegal immigrants crossing over, taking Americans' benefits, to now Kamala Harris saying that it's the right thing to do to stand up and make sure that President Trump continues to do the right thing. Trump derangement syndrome is a real thing, and it's almost like they forgot. We can look back and see what they said 5 minutes ago. President Trump is putting America first, because America first certainly isn't allowing people to infiltrate our country and kill our people.
So, Congressman, the one thing you got to do when you stay in there is you got to get production. We got to get the manufacturing back to mass manufacture these interceptors and all our equipment. There's really no excuse for it at this point. We have the innovation. We have Silicon Valley bought in. We've got some of the smartest people in the world who want to be a part of it. There's just no way that we can continue to struggle to get munitions, because we have people that want to pay money to buy our stuff that are our allies, and the Gulf states have proven themselves. So hopefully you can make a difference there. But in terms of what a deal looks like with Iran, I don't see any reason to give in anywhere. No more enrichment. The 1,000 pounds of uranium, we'll pull it out ourselves. Don't ever touch the Strait of Hormuz. No more ballistic missile program. No more funding of the proxies. And then we talk about how we enforce that.
Well, the best way to enforce that is for the people to know that President Trump is serious when he talks. The best way to enforce that is for the negotiators in Iran to understand that if they go back on their word, then they may meet their virgins sooner than they originally expected. This is the only way you can negotiate with people who have no compunction or no reason to want to see you exist any longer. America needs to make sure that we are focused on peace through strength. President Trump is the best negotiator in the world because he's taken seriously. Iran cannot have a nuke. And in just a few short weeks, we are initiating those negotiations using diplomacy. The Strait of Hormuz is open. And Democrats, frankly, who are rooting against American service members, rooting against the American president, I think is unconscionable, and we should call them out on it.
So there's a big Senate race. I'm not sure who. It looks like Rogers got the nomination. He lost by about a half a percentage point to become the next senator from Michigan. We know that the president won Michigan in the last cycle, and he won it in 2016. What's it going to take for you to be governor?
Well, it's going to take all of us pulling in the same direction for me to become governor. Look, in 2020, President Trump and I were on the ballot together, and I got 61,000 votes closer. President Trump won Michigan at least twice. And so I believe that as a result of Gretchen Whitmer and Jocelyn Benson's hanky-panky in 2020, we fell a little bit short. But we're coming back. We get back up when we get knocked down. I'm in Congress serving the people right now. And we are focused forward into the future, bringing a bold, conservative, positive plan to make Michigan stronger. You just mentioned about those munitions. Michigan is home to the arsenal of democracy. When we have a governor in Michigan who's focused on local control, who's focusing on repealing the income tax, who's focusing on regulatory reform and making Michigan a place where we don't just make jobs, but we create job creators. When we have a Michigan currently that's 44th in education, and we focus over the next 10 years making ourselves number one, we become a home for freedom, and we become an area where people like my parents can come to for a better life and for a better opportunity. These are the types of things that people will come to Michigan and stay in Michigan for, and I'm excited to have the opportunity to lead forward in the future. Having a strong top of ticket in Michigan is the most important thing to make sure that we hold on to the Senate and we hold on to the House. We've seen these cases when we don't have strong tops of tickets, and we end up jeopardizing that. But when we do have a strong top of ticket running as governor, we not only can turn Michigan back around, but we can make sure we hold a majority in Washington for President Donald J. Trump.
So this guy, Hassan Piker of Michigan, he's a radical leftist who just hates people like you, Republicans. How do I know it? He's actually said it. And now you have people like Ro Khanna and others who say, well, I don't agree with him, everything, but I'll appear with him and I'll go on his podcast. I want people at home to realize that this guy has got a lot of following. He's he's on Twitch. He's got a huge podcast, and his ideas could not be more radical. Listen.
America deserved 9/11, dude. F- I'm saying it.
So what makes it interesting for me, at least, is like seeing so many people from all around the country literally travel here just to see this.
That part is insane. Look how many.
Like, I just don't. Like, I don't have any sort of patriotism in my heart for any. Yeah, for America, but just in general.
It doesn't matter if rapes happen on October 7th. Like, that doesn't change the dynamic for me even this much.
So, I mean, and I could play worse. He says Republicans are terrorists. He'd vote for Hamas over Republicans. So why, if you're a politician, even if you're a Democrat, this guy claims to be a Democrat, why would you appear with this guy? Why would you not denounce this guy?
Because you agree with him. That's why. You appear with him and you, with knowing what he said and what he's done, because you agree with him. And you can't separate that when you're talking about being willing to allow other Americans die. That's crazy talk. That's dangerous talk. And so I don't know why he has not been denounced by people who frankly, when anything ever happens, they always say we need to turn down the temperature. But then when you look at the people who are actually turning up the temperature, they do nothing to change it. So they're continuing to carouse and to campaign with this hateful human being. And frankly, I think they are going to pay the consequences of that with losing votes, continue to hemorrhage votes, because the people of the country aren't with this. And Democrats haven't learned anything from 2024. And frankly, good.
You want to hear good? In New York, we got a mayor who is a radical socialist. And finally, the president's given up on him and say he's destroying the city, which I'm watching. Here's what this guy said. And this is the new mantra from the hottest politicians on the left. Cut 31.
That is the change that government can deliver. And it is the change that democratic socialism can deliver. I know there are many who use socialist as a dirty word, something to be ashamed of. They can try all they want, but we will not be ashamed of using government to fight for the many, not simply the few.
Proud of it. They used to be a scarlet letter.
Yeah, it used to be a scarlet letter because it never works. You can't find a single place in the world where socialism, communism, Marxism works long term. You can't find it. They say that the states are the laboratories of democracy. Well, we've already seen where in places like Michigan, we've tried these Green New Deal energy policies, and now we have our energy companies that are going back for two rate increases in a row, crushing Michigan ratepayers. We've already seen where socialism hurts, where we have an education system that's falling to the bottom of the barrel around the country. It doesn't work. And so I guess Mayor Mamdani wants to continue to be stuck on stupid. And he's going to show where one of the greatest cities in the world can be destroyed by Marxism. I feel sorry for the people of the state of New York and New York City. It's a beautiful city. But right now, my focus is on Michigan and making sure we don't go New York's direction. We have to make sure that we are continuing to be a bastion of freedom. And we have an opportunity in 2026 to save our state, because I believe that our state has an outsized role in helping to save our nation, our republic, and also Western civilization.
All right, Congressman, thanks so much. Always appreciate having you on. Best of luck.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We went on this extraordinary journey, and I think it probably looked pretty smooth to everyone on the ground. It was very smooth to us overall, but things can happen. And when we accepted risks in this program, and when you accept them, they can come to fruition. And if they do, it gets really tough for the team, and you can lose a crew. And even though we're going to do our best, people have to understand it's not always going to go perfectly, and we have to trust one another that we can, in the moment, adapt, overcome challenges. That's going to be important, because Artemis II is super challenging. It gets a lot harder from here.
That is one of the astronauts from Artemis II, Jeremy Hansen, talking about the mission, the dangers of it, and what's going to be next. Now, Artemis III is going to be about hooking up with the would-be lander. Artemis 4 will be actually landing on the moon. They think the south side of the moon, they'll have four people on it. Two will get off and two will walk the moon. Now, if we don't get this done in 28, 29, right now, China, and I assume they're on target, says they're going to walk the moon in 2030. What they've asked is for Blue Origin and SpaceX to come up with a lander, because we got the vehicle. Now we need a lander to be able to take this astronaut, switch spacesuits, and then go down to the moon. And they think it'll be the south side of the moon, a place we have not been on the moon again. So that's going to be key, and it's going to cost money, and you got to keep people interested in it. So what is the schedule? Artemis 3, 2027, middle, crew of four, the mission, Earth orbit, okay, and near-Earth testing mission. They also are going to look with Artemis 3. They're going to have Orion spacecraft with a lunar lander like SpaceX Starship or Blue Origin Blue Moon. There'll be a test rendezvous and a docking in space. And remember, the way I understand it, if it's similar to the Apollo mission, you take that, you get in, and then the lander actually goes right down to the moon, but the spaceship continues to circle, and then you go back to the ship, and then you go home. So we did it in the 70s, 60s and 70s, and you got to feel we can do it now. Now, Artemis 4 is the mission to the moon, and they believe that'll be 2028. They say it'll be the three will be like a dress rehearsal. And then if everything goes well, they'll 28, they'll be on four, and then four will send astronauts into lunar orbit, dock on the lunar lander, land two astronauts on the moon, likely to South Pole, stay on the surface, do science, collect samples. Now, they're also going to be constructing a city. We're going to be sending rockets up and putting stuff on the moon to be set up like a campground. And then they want to find a way to get that frozen water out. Some call it ice. And you be able to live on the moon with water from the moon. Got to make sure it's clean. What it's made of. How it got there. I don't know. A lot of questions. I'm interested though. Are you? BrianKilmeade.com. Write me. I'll be able to read it next hour. Keep it here. Brian Kilmeade Show.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. I come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. We have a lot going on. Former New York Giants coach, Hall of Famer Tom, I think he's in the Hall of Fame, should be. Two-time Super Bowl champion with the New York Giants. He was fantastic as he launched the Jacksonville Jaguars, and he helped bring John Harbaugh in. But perhaps his greatest work is with the J Fund. 31 years he's been running that fund to honor one of his players who sadly lost his life to cancer, and now he's helping thousands of families and kids who have cancer and overcome it the best they can. So Tom Coughlin's going to be with us shortly. He's one of our favorite guests. He's got a great biography, too. Standing by is Chris Burnett. He is running for mayor in the 6th Congressional District. He is a longtime Marine. 24 years, served a long time, JAG officer, as well as serving a long time in the Middle East. And we have a lot of moving parts right now, one of which the president's put out, Truth Social, that's affecting the market positively, essentially saying the Strait of Hormuz is open and a deal for everything is about to be executed, everything that we need. I want to hear the Iranians say it, but so far the foreign minister has said the Strait is open. Big three.
Number three. They just literally disappeared, left all of their devices at home. This is not normal. These are some of the most advanced scientists, researchers, some of the most important people for a nation's national security efforts, and they all just mysteriously disappeared.
Where'd they go? Scientist after scientist died, murdered, or flat out disappeared. Suicide? Is this all unrelated? Is this just a coincidence? Even the president cannot say that for sure. Tell me for sure.
Number two.
The entire mission was one profound experience after another.
But when you see it against the blackness of the universe, you recognize that it's not an absolute. It's something to love and that unites us.
That's going to be important because Artemis 2 is super challenging. It gets a lot harder from here.
Yep, Artemis 2, crew speaks. The remarkable crew and details on the next mission and the mission after that to follow.
Number one.
Iran wants to make a deal, and we're dealing very nicely with them. We've got to have no nuclear weapons. If we do, that's a big factor. And they're willing to do things today that they weren't willing to do 2 months ago.
So almost over. President's blockade, he believes, has broken Iran to the point that a deal could get done. In fact, he might even go to Pakistan if it's that close and sign it. So this is why we should feel optimistic. You ready? He put this up about 30 minutes ago. The Strait of Hormuz is completely open and ready for business in full passage. But the naval blockade will remain in full force and effect as it pertains to Iran only until such time our transaction is complete. 100% complete. The process should be go very quickly in that most of the points already negotiated. Then he followed it up with this. The USA will get nuclear dust, meaning 1,000 pounds of uranium created by our B-2 bombers. No money will exchange hands in any way, shape, or form. The deal is in no way subjected to Lebanon either, but the USA will separately work with Lebanon and deal with the Hezbollah situation in an appropriate manner. Israel will not be bombing Lebanon any longer. They are prohibited from doing so by the U.S. Enough is enough. Thank you. So besides that, the market believes it. They're up 900 points. Overall, the Dow is at 49,400. Chris Burnett, a lot of fast-moving news, and this is part of the reason I guess you want to run for Congress, to be part of this decision-making, right?
That's exactly right. I see this as an extension of my service as a Marine.
So you know what it's like to do a blockade. You know what it's like to get ready for war. You know what it's like to be in a war. What do you think it's like now for our men and women in the Middle East in this 10-day ceasefire?
No, I can only speak to my experience and the Marines I worked with. This is exactly where they want to be. This is what you train for. This is what you look for. This is why you join the military. You want to be held to a high standard. You want to be at the tip of the spear, and you want to be ready when called upon.
So I assume they've showed you that they were ready when they were called upon, right?
I think they've demonstrated not only were they ready, they've exceeded expectations. This has been nothing short of an extraordinary tactical achievement. We're now putting together the strategic outcome, but the tactical success is quite literally unprecedented.
So the UAE is taking a bow, too. They feel very good about what they were able to do. And I'll give you some of the statement they just put out through their ambassador. Iran lost, and yes, the UAE won. We were subjected to more than 2,800 Iranian missiles and drones, and we shot down 96% of them. Iran believed that the UAE was an open field, but we confronted the attack with complete efficiency and superiority. So this is just an example of our Arab Gulf allies not wavering in battle, right?
That's exactly right. And I think what we also saw here was we have endured Iran holding the entire region at threat for far too long. This was overdue. I think everybody in the region, both Iran's neighbors and U.S. service members that have been stationed there, that we were held at risk and directly at threat of an Iranian or IRGC attack for the last 47 years. This was overdue, and to see decisive engagement, decisive leadership here to bring this to a good outcome is overdue, and I can see why it's being celebrated throughout the region.
Well, not everyone agrees with you. In fact, 97% of the media and every Democrat, they said it's a faux pas, this is a big mistake, it's unnecessary, you're breaking with your mantra of America first, no more foreign wars. Listen to, for example, Kamala Harris, Cut 10.
Everyone, so I'm here in Charlotte since the start of Trump's war of choice. It's $15 more every time you fill up your tank of gas. The price of diesel has now gone up 80% since the start of the war. And you best believe that's going to carry over to how much you're paying for all the goods that are being transported on those semis. We've got a president who is paying more attention to what he thinks is in his best political interest and personal interest as opposed to what is in the best interest of working people in America.
Chris, she was quoted in 2024 saying Iran was our number one enemy. And when she talks about gas prices, remember she talked about the price of democracy? I mean, what are your thoughts about this? Normally, if you were just a Marine, I wouldn't bring into the political fray, but you want into the politics, so have at it.
Well, it always shocks me that either they're willfully ignorant or they simply don't understand national security and foreign policy. If you don't see this as ensuring peace, lasting peace that will inevitably benefit the United States and the global economy, then quite frankly, you shouldn't be in a position of authority. What she just said is not just an oversimplification, it's just plain wrong. And if you're talking about gas prices, when we're talking about national security and foreign policy, you're just not prepared to make the decisions that need to be made in this type of a moment.
So I want you to hear this Congresswoman, Sydney Dove of California, about this war. Cut 13.
Are you concerned about the impact that this war in Iran is having on our national debt?
Oh, my God. Yes, of course I am. You would, Stevie Wonder can even see how much this is costing us. So gas prices are going up. It's almost $10 in California. And fertilizer is going up. I mean, you name it, the prices have gone up. And this dude, Dr. Jesus, okay, is wanting to spend $2 billion of your money every single day rather than help you get health care. His ass.
Classy. Your thoughts?
That doesn't even really dignify a response, but for the fact that she is a congresswoman. I mean, if that's the caliber of our discourse, that's why we can't solve any problems. The reality is we have to address this like any other problem. It's a nuanced problem that's being dealt with directly. This is also why whenever you see arbitrary war powers resolutions being brought to the floor and being voted down, you cannot politicize foreign policy and national security. If you don't act with one voice and you don't act with some level of decisiveness and you have this level of discourse, we're going to find ourselves falling further and further behind. And she failed to mention that what she is discussing, a lot of these financial issues in California are spending issues at the state level, not at all related to what we're doing with national security and foreign policy. The current uptick will be offset by the peace and stability that will be secured by this for decades to come.
So let's talk about politics in Virginia. They're going to be voting on redistricting. And that's something that Governor Spanberger said she, when she was a candidate, she was not going to do. Here's what she said, cut 16, is what she why she's doing it now and why we need, she says Virginia needs four more seats, cut 16.
In fact, in Virginia, just a few years ago, we passed a bipartisan redistricting amendment, which is why now to do this temporary redistricting, we actually need to do another referendum. I vocally supported that bipartisan redistricting commission. And importantly, important to me and important to many Virginians, is that this referendum, this temporary redistricting, preserves that bipartisan commission into the long term. And so after the next census, that bipartisan commission will come back online and do our next redistricting. But it's important that Virginia be responsive in this moment.
So she wants four more seats. You know, in fairness, Trump did say the gerrymanderings were done by the Democrats. We're going to fix it and push back. And he started in Texas. California responded. Other places went back and forth. How do you feel about what Virginia's doing, your neighboring state?
Well, I'll start with, I never liked the idea of gerrymandering in any direction. I think there should be a standardized process in all 50 states. Anything that we do to take away votes of American citizens is a problem. So what they're doing in Virginia is the worst example of gerrymandering. And that word salad, she couldn't even get out the justification other than to say being responsive in the moment is essentially going to redistrict Virginia so as to take away Republican voice, to take away registered Republicans from having a voice in government. I think it's shameful.
So right now there's only one Republican. There's only one Republican congressman in Maryland. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So are you're running for a district, you're competing, it's going to be a primary on June 23rd, and your primary election's against fellow Republican Robin Ficker and Mariela Rocha for the party nomination. What do you do differently? What do you bring to the table that they don't?
So first and foremost, you know, I'm bringing 22 years of service. I retired from the Marine Corps, at 22 years active, 24 years since my commissioning, 22 years of service with five combat deployments. What I'm bringing to this is the selfless leadership that comes with serving in the Marine Corps and serving overseas. The idea of any Marine Corps officer is that you exist solely to set the conditions for other people to succeed. And that's exactly what I want to do in Congress. And in addition to leading selflessly, I've already proposed an economic redevelopment package called the Western Maryland Innovation Corridor, and it's leveraging national security priorities with AI, quantum computing, and advanced manufacturing aligned to how we control data centers arriving in the region, namely to include a small modular reactor and a water treatment plant. And if we do this the right way, we can quite literally reinvent the economy of Western Maryland without displacing a single blade of grass and farmland or having any other mismanagement at the state level.
Chris, it's so interesting because that is one of the hottest debates. state to state. And I think they're about to say no in Maine. So if you say no to a data center, all you're saying, and the president's for this, provide the energy. Don't up the people's utility bills, but don't run from having a data center, right? So have That's the correct. Energy with the data center. Don't run from modernization.
That's exactly right. You know, whenever you allow the data centers to produce their own energy, not only could they offset any burden on the localized grid, with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission licensing and permitting these, we could potentially plug it into the grid and offset residential costs. So now, instead of it being a burden to the grid, it could actually be enhancing it by diversifying our supply.
Right. And the thing is, too, don't you want to bring those jobs to your state? Don't you want people to come to your state?
That's exactly right. This is built around the idea that we can leverage federal highway funds in our federal highway network to rebuild infrastructure, set the conditions so that these data centers are properly built, aligned with local residents, actually supplement their local needs. And most importantly, in addition to the data centers, you co-locate advanced manufacturing because those are the good paying, enduring jobs.
Well, Chris, thanks so much for your service. Thanks for your military insight and best of luck in Maryland. We hope to see you again. Talk to you again and good luck in June.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. Chris Burnett, no nonsense Marine running for the Maryland 6th Congressional District. Bottom of the hour, Tom Coughlin joins us. But you're next. 1-866-408-7669. We're following the story. And it's a good one. Oil is now down to trading at $83 a barrel. The market's approaching 50,000 again. It's at 49,500, up almost 1,000 points. On the announcement, not rebuked by anyone on the Iranian side, that we're about to get everything we want, including the nuclear dust, which is 1,000 pounds of uranium from Iran. I mean, I don't trust them either. But man, did things change in a week. You're listening to Brian Kilmeade Show.
Real talk, real guests, real insight. Where curiosity meets conversation. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I mean, Anna Lilia Mejia is running the Mamdani playbook right here in New Jersey. She's running on tax the billionaires. She's running on radical spending increases. And as we're seeing in New York, when the billionaires leave and you don't have those options, who gets taxed? Everybody else. That is exactly what is going to happen here if we allow Anna Lilia Mejia to represent us in Washington.
Unfortunately, Joe Hathaway got crushed, and he wants a rematch in November. He's a very impressive guy, former mayor, councilman. As a Republican, I guess it was hard getting traction and people to show up on a Thursday in the middle of nowhere. Meaning, what are we doing? Voting in April. Why? Because a special election. Why was that day picked? Time to make sure the turnout was low, in my view. But Mejia won, and she's going to become a member of the squad if the squad's left-wing enough for her. I mean, she was mentored by Bernie Sanders, loved by AOC, looked up to by the mayor of New York City, now trying to distancing herself. Here's what she had to say, Cut 24.
Will you be the latest member of the squad?
I am going to be maybe one of the very few women who have children in school in school age. Do you know that in Congress, it's approximately 7% of our representatives are mothers with school age children. That reflects in our policymaking. I think if we send moms to Congress, we will have better policy. We will be focused on education. We will be focused on the needs of the sandwich generation. We will be focused on helping families thrive, not just survive. So I would say I would be a member of a very, very tiny group of people, women with school-aged children who are trying to impact America.
Right. So have $25 minimum wage. $25, all right? And then, of course, free health care. But where are you going to do that? You're going to raise taxes. And you're in the highest tax state, second or third highest tax state in the country. This is what happens. When you elect these left-wingers, people that don't have to stay in the area, and some people do for work, some people do because it costs money to move, they're just going to leave. What's happening in Jersey? I'm gone. What's happening in New York City? I mean, we had Jamie Dimon in here. And he built this beautiful building a few blocks from us. It's on 47th Street. You got to see this building. It's space age. But more people are in Dallas right now. More people are in Dallas. He said, why? Because a lot of people want to work in Dallas instead of New York City. Can you believe it? I mean, that's in my words. Can you believe it? And it's cheaper. And there's incentives to build there. They want to build there. And if you have to build a house, you can build a house. Even Mayor Mondami admitted it before he became mayor. There's so much red tape. There's so much regulation, so many environmental restraints. Before you do anything, nothing ever gets built. And by the time it gets built using unions and whatever, it's cost prohibitive. So people say, forget it. People with money, why do I want to do that? I can go to Texas, and they're incentivized me to build instead of places like New York City, where their big brainchild was, let's tax people who have second homes here worth more than $5 million more money. If they can afford to leave that house empty or that apartment empty or that condo empty, they can afford to pay more. That's the twisted mindset.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Third down and five. Pressure from Thomas off the edge. Eli Manning stays on his feet. Airs it out down the field. It is caught by Tyree inside the 25 and a timeout taken.
Oh, my God. This ball's thrown, and Tyree just goes up for it like a basketball player. Harrison trying to knock it down. And Eli, man, I don't know how he got out of there. I thought he was on the ground, and then he came out of the pile and just slings it. That's a great catch by David Tyree.
No kidding. And we'd keep the Giants' game, the hopes alive for a Super Bowl championship, which they go on and beat the undefeated Patriots 17-14. A guy that doesn't need to be reminded of that because he made it happen. He was the head coach of the New York Giants, two-time Super Bowl champion. Tom Coughlin, former Jacksonville Jaguars coach, the first one they've ever had, and Boston College coach, too. Tom, welcome back to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Great to see you, Coach.
Hey, Brian, great to see you. It's been a while.
I know. You look great. Your thoughts hearing that again?
Yeah, well, I started smiling when I did hear it. That was a moment when I was, you know, right there on the sideline, right across from Eli, and I just yelled out to Mike Carey, the official, don't blow it dead, don't blow it dead, because it looked like he was in that kind of position where, you know, the official could have blown it dead, and somehow you saw Eli kind of scramble out of that. Throw the ball down the middle of the field, and then I'm thinking, oh, God, if he overthrows this, ball overthrown in the middle of the field is an interception. David Tyree goes up, makes the greatest catch in the history of the Super Bowls. It took me a long time to teach him that catch, by the way. He goes high in the air. He catches the ball in two hands. One arm gets ripped away by Harrison, who's a 220-pound safety. So he automatically pins the ball to his helmet as he goes down. Harrison goes across the back of his knees, which if you're playing in the backyard, you know, usually the ball goes flying out when somebody threatens your knees. And he somehow, David Tyree, hung on to the ball. But, you know, the interesting thing about it, Brian, still, we're still going through a 3rd and 11 to get to the point where we score the touchdown to win the game. And that's where, you know, Steve Smith comes in with that great play.
So, wow, besides that, you don't remember much about it. And David Tyree, again, would not play another game, right? That would be it for him.
Well, yeah. No, he was injured. Okay, yeah. And unfortunately, but he'll never be forgotten for that play he made.
And remember this, cut 47.
Manning lobs it. Burris alone. Touchdown, New York. Plaxico Burris had been held down all night. As big a reason why the Giants got past the Packers in the NFC Championship game with his 11 catches, 151 yards, did not have a catch the entire second half, two all night.
Plaxico would make the winning catch. I was actually at the Super Bowl watching that on the field.
Blitz.
He covered it.
A loud blitz right there, Brian. You know, Eli's in the huddle, and he said, if they single cover you, Plax, I'm coming to you. And they did. They brought the house, of course, blitz zero. And in our studies, Plaxico and our entire offensive team had noticed the different ways in which people react when the blitz is coming. And Plaxico faked the slant move, which caused the corner to sit a little bit, went by him. The ball is up in the air for the touchdown. The interesting thing there, Brian, is with about 20 minutes left to go before I had to turn the inactive sheet in, I didn't know Plaxico was even going to play because he had a knee injury, didn't practice all week. But because he played, he was double teamed most of the day, which helped us in other areas of our game.
You were convinced, I understand it, I don't want to put words in your mouth, and of course you'll correct me. When you played them in the last game of the season, you were convinced you could play with them, right?
We were. When we came off the field, we really believed it. And as we were walking off, I could hear the Patriot players talking, and they knew they had won the game, and there's no doubt about it. And that was clearly stated to our team afterwards. We didn't win, but it was a heck of a game, but totally different from the Super Bowl, 38-35 versus 17-14.
The other thing, Coach, in the big picture, I've been dying to ask you this. When Eli was having those years in which it was people were doubting whether he was going to become this great quarterback, you never expressed doubt. And he was back talking to his old college coach, trying to get his confidence back. But you are this tough coach, you no-nonsense coach, all about winning. But yet there was something that you saw in Eli, and it took him a few years to get traction. What did you see in him that maybe other people wouldn't?
Just remember, Brian, that his rookie year, when after about seven games, I instituted him into the starting lineup.
Kurt Warner to the bench.
Kurt Warner was our quarterback. And they battled it in preseason, but Kurt won it. Kurt started. But along about the time we were 4-3, we had kind of stalled and didn't play well in Arizona. So I decided to make the move right there. And it was a difficult transition for any rookie quarterback because they've never seen the speed and the way in which the blitz went about. But he fought his way through that. It wasn't easy. And you remember we beat the Cowboys in the last game of the year, where he made a great check at the one-inch line to score a touchdown rather than, you know, kick a field goal to tie. So anyway, I knew the ingredients in Eli. And Eli, in my opinion, the greatest, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, big-game quarterbacks of all time. The way he played through those two Super Bowl runs when nobody gave us a chance to win, really, nobody. And he provided that, the plays, the consistency, didn't turn the ball over. We turned it over once in that 07 Super Bowl run, again in 11, the way he played and people. He just proved it to everybody at that time. But I knew what was deep down inside him.
Tom Coughlin, our guest, I don't want to go too long without talking about the J Fund. 30 plus years you did this. Tell everyone how this started. You had this player in Boston College, gets cancer, passes away, and that really affected you to the point where you launched this pediatric cancer foundation, and you continue to make it bigger and bigger. Could you tell everybody about it?
Well, when I was the head coach at Boston College, my strong safety was a young man by the name of Jay McGillis. He was a great kid, a great teammate, you know, just a humble, solid young man, great in school. And after 10 games, we came back and the doctors and trainer came to me and said they didn't think Jay could play the following weekend. I said, well, what's going on? Why can't he play? Can't get the doctors in here. Let's get him treated. He has a temperature. He has swollen glands. Well, it wasn't a cold or wasn't something along those lines. It was leukemia and a ravaging form of leukemia. Jay was gone July 3rd of 1992. This was the season of 91. But going through that, watching the family, being with the family, watching how the parents drop everything, run to the bedside of the sick child, and witnessing all of this, and having in the spring the ability, Mike Panos, a linebacker of mine, came and said, the McGillises need help. So the players went into the community. They raised $50,000. We gave the McGillis family a check for $50,000 at halftime of the spring game. And the impact that experience had on my wife, Judy, and I We knew if we ever had a chance to give back, it would be in the name, image, and likeness of Jay McGillis. And that's where the J Fund Foundation started in 1996. And 31 years later, Brian, we've helped over 6,700 families to the tune of $39 million.
And now today, that's amazing. And now today you're announcing your first ever ambassador class as you enter year 31. Tell us about that.
All right. We are doing just that. Today we are recognizing four individuals who have been tremendous supporters of the J Fund, who have completely bought into the mission of the J Fund, who have established themselves in their own communities and are giving back, okay, are giving back. But they are individuals who we recognize with great gratitude what they mean to their communities and what they've meant to the J Fund. You have Juan Carlos Amores, the head coach of the Gotham women's soccer team. You have Logan Cook, the punter of the Jacksonville Jaguars. Ross Matisic, the Pro Bowl long snapping of the Jacksonville Jaguars. And Chris Snee, who is currently a senior scout with the New York Giants, who is a Pro Bowl right guard for me, two Super Bowl champions. These individuals who, when they do get involved with J Fund functions, whenever they're asked, they're there. Then they're not only there, they're there with their heart, their commitment, their soul. And so we are recognizing them at this point because they will then continue to spread the word in the community to new people for the involvement of new people in our great work, in our great cause. And so we're recognizing the ambassador program, kicking it off today in the 31st year of the J Fund.
Awesome. Great. Now, for you personally, Coach, I know your wife passed away. How are you dealing with that? You two were incredibly close. She's your biggest supporter throughout your entire football career. How have you dealt with that?
Well, not well. I don't, someone who we were married for 55 years, and Judy was the person behind the scenes who allowed me to do what we were able to do. And if it wasn't for her, that would not have happened. So she suffered terribly with a terrible disease. It's not an easy thing to go through.
I know.
But she did. She died November 2nd of 2022. But her spirit is still very much in the J Fund because she was right there with me to establish it.
So, and people that know Coach Tom Coughlin, he's just one of the most honorable people you're going to meet in and out of sports. Coach, you weren't done contributing to the Giants. Because of you, we had this announcement a few months ago.
I know the challenges. I understand the expectations. I know the fans are hungry for a winner. We're here with one mission, to become, to earn the right to be called the world champions in New York.
Why was it important for you to express to John Harbaugh to take this job?
When John was fired in Baltimore, I sent him a text congratulating him on his years of service, on the accomplishments that he had. And his response was in text, thank you, blah, blah, blah. But I could use some advice right now if you have a minute. So that became the phone call that I made to John, and John had many questions for me. There was a lot of things that we had to go through, but John's credibility brings so much to the Giants. Okay. The man has 193 wins in the National Football League. He's a tremendous person, tremendous coach. We believe that that's what the Giants needed at this time. And so, knowing full well, that John Mara was ill and so on and so forth. Chris Mara actually was the guy that got involved and put this thing completely together. And John is on board, and the excitement in New York is great.
What do you think? Do you think they could, the Giants can go back to the winning ways, which they have not had since you left?
I think so. Yes, I believe so. And I think John's the man to lead them in that direction.
Got the right quarterback?
Yeah, I hope so. You know, I'm not the guy that sits around studying everything, but what I've saw, he's an outstanding young player, and he does have to learn to get down.
Yeah, he wants to run through people. We know about that.
It's not going to work.
Right.
It's not going to work at this level.
And lastly, Coach, if people listen to the Jay Fund, hear about the mission, hear about your ambassadors, where do they go to contribute?
Well, jfund.org. We're on the internet. Just Google the Jay Fund Foundation, and we will accept your contributions with open arms.
For pediatric cancer especially. I mean, how can you go wrong? Tom Coughlin, Coach, I'll see you again soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian. Have a great day.
You too. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Back in a moment.
The headlines, the stories behind them, and the people who make them. Only on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
There are these 10 missing scientists with access to classified stuff, nuclear material, aerospace. They've all gone missing or turned up dead in the last couple months. Based on what you've been briefed, what do you think is happening here? And do you think that this is connected or totally random?
Well, I hope it's random, but we're going to know in the next week and a half. I just left a meeting on that subject, so... Yeah, pretty serious stuff, but we're going to be hopefully, I don't know, coincidence, if you want it, whatever you want to call it, but some of them were very important people, and we're going to look at it over the next session.
So we're talking about these scientists that have disappeared. I mean, they're all extremely bright. They're either nuclear involved with the UFO program. I mean, you got to see these bios on these guys and this woman. One woman disappeared hiking. Others shot. 59-year-old dies mysteriously. 59-year-old. So you expect when you see these stories, I'm like thinking to myself, okay, where did I read that? Keep reading it. And then you think, well, when the president hears this and when it gets to the White House, they'll be able to make sense of it or say that we've investigated and there's no link. But instead they say, we're investigating this and we have great concerns about it. So that to me is pretty significant. And we're going to follow it. And I'm sure this is going to get bigger and bigger. And I think, and as I asked the congressman this morning, can we get Democrats and Republicans working in the same direction on this? So Trump says he's looking into it. It's just an idea of some of these people. This William McCaslin disappeared in February, had deep ties to the Air Force Research Program. Disappeared. Who disappears today? Monica Reza vanished while hiking under unclear circumstances. Two scientists shot in their homes. One researcher working on anti-gravity technology allegedly died by suicide after warning her life was in danger. And the Daily Mail has reported that Michael David Hicks, a longtime NASA JPL scientist involved in asteroid and comet research, died in 2023 with no public cause of death disclosed, making the ninth case in a growing list of deaths and disappearances. Pretty serious stuff. So let's find out who would be interested in this. Who are some of our enemies? Iran, obviously. Who are some of our competitors? And our, I would argue, enemies, China and Russia. So what do they know? And what I'm wondering, too, is when someone disappears, I mean, give you the Guthrie case, someone disappears, the whole country rallies around. Now, I know Savannah Guthrie's famous, but if not, if someone disappears, I'm under the impression that those families are going to do everything locally and nationally to let it get word out, especially if you have a prominent member of your family or a friend that disappears, it's running a top secret nuclear program. You would think that there's going to be the best people on it. The FBI is alerted to it. Now, I don't know, the FBI's not looking into it, but why wouldn't it work to your advantage? And I'll ask investigators this, to get this public, at least one of them, the McCaslin family, the Reza family, the Hicks family. So this is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And it is a coincidence. It's pretty amazing. Someone's got to explain to me the odds of somebody with these type of expertise all disappearing within. It really began in 2023. Here we are within 3 years. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show as we close out our final hour of the week. This hour, I got Nate Boyd, fresh off an appearance in the Middle East for a considerable amount of time during the five-week war, which may have be coming to an end. At the bottom of the hour, Julian Epstein standing by after that. Most left-wing congresswoman in the country just elected last night in New Jersey to replace the governor because Mikey Sherrill, as you know, won the governor's race. We're all looking at the news coming out now of the Middle East is so good for the market. It's up over 1,000 points. We're closing in on 50,000. So for those people lining up speeches that the president's done this horrible job against Iran and not focusing at home, good luck with that. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
They just literally disappeared, left all of their devices at home. This is not normal. These are some of the most advanced scientists, researchers, some of the most important people for nation's national security efforts, and they all just mysteriously disappeared.
It's nuts. Where do they go? Where do the scientists go? What do they have in common? All in the prime of their lives, almost all disappeared or dead under mysterious circumstances. Even the president's befuddled.
Number two.
The entire mission was one profound experience after another.
But when you see it against the blackness of the universe, you recognize that it's not an absolute. It's something to love and that unites us.
That's going to be important because Artemis II is super challenging. It gets a lot harder from here.
Artemis II, yep, crew speaks. This remarkable crew is fantastic. But now the mission, Artemis 3 and 4, we'll go into detail on it.
Number one.
Iran wants to make a deal, and we're dealing very nicely with them. We've got to have no nuclear weapons. If we do, that's a big factor. And they're willing to do things today that they weren't willing to do 2 months ago.
Almost over. President's blockade, he believes, has broken Iran to the point that a deal could be done. But we should not give in on any deal points. We've gotten on the offensive for a reason. And we'll talk about that, too. So let me just give you an idea of what has taken place. Over the last hour or two, on Truth Social kind of tells the story. And by the way, brilliant of the president. You knocked him off social media, so he formed his own and now making a ton of money off it while informing the American public. He said, Iran has agreed to never close the Strait of Hormuz again. It will no longer be used as a weapon against the world. The president says if we're close to a deal and it's everything he wants, he might go to Pakistan. That's an 18-hour journey. A great and brilliant day for the world. Thank you to Pakistan, its great prime minister and field marshal, two fantastic people. Again, the deal is not tied to any way to Lebanon, but we will make Lebanon great again. I'm going backwards in time now. Iran, with the help of the USA, has removed or is removing all sea mines. Thank you. He goes back in. This goes back 52 minutes. Thank you to Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Qatar for your bravery and help. This goes back 55 minutes. Now that the Hormuz Strait situation is over, I received a call from NATO asking if we would need some help. I told them to stay away unless they just want to load up their ships with oil. They were useless when needed. The USA will get a nuclear dust, meaning this is 1 hour ago. The USA will get nuclear dust created by our great B-2 bombers. That's last year's mission. No money will be exchanged hands in any way. The deal is in no way subjected to Lebanon either, but the U.S. will separately work with Lebanon and deal with Hezbollah situation in an appropriate manner. Israel will not be bombing Lebanon again. Okay, let's see. Thank you to Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Qatar for your bravery. I got it. Now that the Hormuz, it just reset. I apologize for that. And now this is the big one. The Strait of Hormuz is completely open and ready for business, full passage, but the naval blockade will remain in full force and effect as it will pertain to Iran only until such time as our transaction with Iran is 100% complete. The process should be over very quickly in that most of the points are already negotiated. Thank you for your attention to that. So here we go. I mean, the markets responded there in positive, but this is what I woke up to. So as soon as I hear the president speak optimistically, and this is what he said in his last comments on this, cut to.
With the peace talks in Iran, does it have to be a big deal all at once, or would you accept a little deal to start?
Well, I have a little deal. I can make a little deal. I want to get it done and get back to peace. keep going with low, you know, our pricing is doing great. As soon as the war is over, we're going to be lower than we were 2 or 3 years ago. So I want to get back to that.
Then anyone on to say this, cut three.
We had to do something. We had to make sure that Iran never gets a nuclear weapon. And we're at that. They've agreed to that. They've totally agreed to that. They've agreed to almost everything. So maybe if they can get to the table, there's a difference. They agree. They got to get to the table with a pen. We'll have that over with. And then we can focus on our great economy. And also, you know, I inherited the highest prices in the history of our country, the worst inflation in the history of our country. I'll get it down to a very low number. We had it to a very low number, and it's still low. But the most important thing right now is to make sure Iran can never have a nuclear weapon.
Right. And there's a couple other things that have to be in this deal. No more funding of the proxies. Get the roughly 1,000 pounds of uranium out. Number two is zero enrichment. Can't do it. If you want a nuclear program, and I doubt they want a nuclear program, but let's say you want a nuclear program, do what the UAE does, and I think Saudi Arabia does. You enrich outside the country. Everything out. Zero. Don't say 3.5, 1.4. Because if you could do that, then you can quickly ramp it up. And lastly, do not give in on absolutely anything. The strait can never be shut down. Again, it's international waters. The precedent is absolutely terrible. Obviously, people just decide, okay, that like this place like called China. That's straight in front of me. No one getting through. Taiwan's going to be squeezed. So this is what General Keane said. After our military performance and what we've achieved, this should be the deal. Cut eight.
These are less about negotiations in my mind. I know why we want to use that term. But it's more about putting our terms on the table and you take it or leave it.
Absolutely.
And that is the attitude we should have in dealing with these people. There's no face saving here. We're asking them to surrender everything that we want without signing a surrender document. That's the face saving aspect of this. They give us everything that we want, and we've listed all of those.
That's it. There's no way to give in. And I would not release any of the sanctions until it's proven that they've done everything they're supposed to do, because they can never be trusted. Look, they don't trust us. I don't care. But we don't have to do anything for them. They have to do stuff for the rest of the world because of their 47-year track record, let alone the killing of their own people. My hope is they're so weak, they just collapse from within. Those people get a chance at a real life. Joining us now to talk about this, Julian Epstein. Julian, it looks like for now, on the thought that we might have a break in this war and the ceasefire towards an agreement, the markets responded big time, up over 1,000 points.
Yep. I think General Keane is right. I mean, I think there's been a lot of smoke here, but I think what you're going to see is something close to unconditional surrender. You know, what has not been conveyed, I think, adequately by the legacy media is Iran has been devastated in this war. Their military capability has been completely decapitated. Political leadership has been destroyed. But their economy is in tatters. There's been 17,000 strikes, Brian. The petrochemical and the steel industries, which are the main industries in Iran, they may account for as much as half of the workforce, have been completely devastated. The rebuild in Iran is going to cost somewhere between quarter to half a trillion dollars. They're losing half a billion a day. And, you know, I hear this ridiculous argument coming from the left. It used to be that the war was illegal. Okay, that went by the wayside. You know, Obama dropped 92,000 bombs, never had a congressional authorization. But I keep hearing from the left and congressional Democrats that this war has not gone well for the United States. It's gone swimmingly well. The one ace that Iran has, which is the Strait of Hormuz, has been judo flipped. Now, rather than them having the veto, the United States has the veto. I think what Trump has done, he has taken away that card permanently from Iran because the costs are too great. And they're seeing that with the U.S. blockade, where now the U.S. can dictate the terms of movement through the strait rather than Iran. And I think this is all going to end very, very well. And I think what Trump has done is he's risked his entire presidency on this. He's done it because he doesn't want to mortgage the future for a couple of months of comfort. And what he's done, I think, is a profound courage. And I think we are going to prevail. And I think it is going to be a crowning achievement for the president.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be complete victory. That's just it. If they say, well, the 5 years or even the 20 years, we want to enrich for 20 years. I don't even think they need to do that. It's got to be zero enrichment and stop funding the proxies, which is going to be very hard, Julian, to enforce. There's no doubt about it. But what we have now is total clarity from the Gulf states. They can't even pretend that Iran's anything but the enemy in the region. You can't even say, well, it depends on who you know, or there's two sides to every story. They know. They've been targeted for the last 5 weeks.
Well, I think you're going to have to stop the not just the enrichment, but the whole infrastructure. That was the problem that Obama, the mistake that Obama made, was he allowed them to complete, to advance their infrastructure, things like centrifuges. So I think it's going to have to be that. It's going to have to be ballistics. It's going to have to be the terror armies. It's going to have to be a permanent solution on the strait. I think Iran knows that they don't have that card left to play. Yes, I think it's going to have to be complete and total surrender on the part of Iran. And I mean, look at what will result from this. So it's not just that Iran's military threat is going to be defeated. You have almost all of the Gulf states now lining up with the United States and with Israel. Lebanon is now negotiating for the expulsion of Hezbollah. You've had what will look like at the end of this is to be a massive realignment towards the West and towards the United States, and a complete disarmament and defanging of the Iranian nuclear threat. You know, I think the reason that you see, Brian, the left freaking out about this is because they need Trump to fail.
I know.
Because if Trump succeeds, then everything the left stands for is out the window. I mean, the entire approach of the left in the last decade, I've got a piece coming out on this in the New York Post tomorrow. The entire approach of the Democrats and the left in the last decade has been appeasement. That's what the JCPOA was. That's what Biden continually telling Iran to de-escalate in the face of a seven-front war. It was this idea that you can negotiate with that. It's sort of like the idea that Democrats have with criminals. If you just treat bad people nicely, they'll come around to you and they'll obey the rules-based order ultimately. And that's the approach that the Democrats took towards Iran and the Mideast terrorists. If you just negotiate with them, if you just try to acknowledge them, if you give them money, if you appease them, they'll eventually come around. That strategy is an abject failure. And Trump's is a reprise of the peace through strength with a couple of amendments, the building of economic and financial alliances, the madman theory. I think he's updated it in a lot of useful ways. But if Trump prevails, then the Democrats are exposed as completely unserious people without any meaningful plan for dealing with national security.
Just on UAE, they just put this out there, their ambassador. It said, yes, Iran lost, and yes, the UAE won. We were subjected to 2,800 Iranian missiles and drones, and we shot down 96% of them. Iran believed that UAE was an open field, but we confronted the attack with complete efficiency and superiority. And we are proud of our country and our leadership and our society and proud of our national economy. After 40 days of aggression, we emerged stronger and more resilient and more confident than we ever have. Their goal was to make the U.S. One of their statements was to have the U.S. pull out of the Middle East instead with our biggest, we're going to have bigger bases and more of a presence.
Well, but also most of the important countries aligned with us, explicitly aligned with us and against Iran. And this is why I think Jack Keane is right on. The story here, and this has got to be told because there's a lot of reporting about the Obama machine trying to spin this as a loss or as Trump not getting what Obama, as much as Obama got. The story here is not a negotiated solution. The story here has got to be complete surrender and triumph by the United States and the West, primarily the United States and Israel. And that is critical because the lesson that we have to learn from this is that if you try to appease bad people, you will be played as a fool. If you approach them first diplomatically, but if they are in bad faith, the way Iran has always been in bad faith, if you don't back that up with military might, then nobody will ever take you seriously. And what Trump has done is he has restored deterrence and therefore restored U.S. credibility in the region. And, you know, I think most of the Arab states are cheering right. for him and will salute him. And I think the rest of the world owes Trump a bit great debt of gratitude. When this war started, the night it started, you know, I was on Fox News the night of the attack as it was happening. And I said, if this succeeds, this is going to be worthy of Nobel Peace Prize. I've said that. And, you know, I was attacked viciously from the left for saying that. But what you're seeing here is the defeat of what is the closest thing we know to a neo-Nazi Hitler-like regime. And that's not my rhetoric. That's the rhetoric of the Saudi crown prince. The Saudi crown prince said Iran is the closest thing we've known to a modern-day Adolf Hitler. And if we if you imagine Adolf Hitler with a nuclear bomb and with overwhelming overpowering ballistic superiority, what Trump has done is not just taken that away, but he has moved the entire region towards the United States, towards the West, and towards a modern framework. And that is miraculous. We haven't seen anything like that in our lifetime.
Julian Epstein, thanks so much. We got to see what the final deal looks like, but if it is a total capitulation, that's which they should, because they're still shut down the strait. They have no means of revenue. Their currency is falling apart. Their currency is falling apart. Inflation's at 180%. Julian Epstein, thanks so much. Appreciate it. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This is a targeted surcharge on second homes and investor-owned apartments worth over $5 million. Homes that, in many cases, sit vacant for a large part of the year. We have the inventory. They're part of our skyline, but those people are not part of our city.
This is a tax on properties worth more than $5 million that are owned by people who do not reside in New York City. The super wealthy who can purchase properties and use them to store their wealth, to benefit from New York City's real estate market, but not have to pay back into that same city that generates so much of that wealth.
What are you even talking about? Do you even know what you're saying? Do you think because people have a second home, they're not paying taxes on it? They're not holding a mortgage on it? Or if they can afford to pay it, that also helps? Do you know, I didn't even know this, in hearing about this ridiculous tax that they're putting on successful people, the Plaza is now converted into basically condos. Do you know that they can't find enough people to buy up all the condos in New York City? So it's hard. It's so expensive. Can't even find people. So you have a guy like Ken Griffin from Citadel. I never met him. But he's unbelievably wealthy. And they're saying he's got to pay more in taxes for his second home. Do you know what they're going to say? Keep your second home. You're going to double my taxes because I don't live here full time? As if you give me it free because I don't live here full time. So now you're going to double it because I don't live here full time and go to the deli for lunch? I'm gone.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. And thanks so much for listening, everybody. Just finishing up here, Nate Foy is with us in studio, fresh off Fox and Friends first, but more recently, we're just in the recent past, over the Middle East, covering this war as it began over the last 5 weeks. Nate, of course, a fantastic correspondent with the channel. Nate, first off, fast-moving news. The market's up just about 1,000 points. The overall, it's at almost 50,000 again. On the news, not denied, and I'm looking everywhere to make sure it's true. The foreign minister of Iran says the same thing as our president. He says the strait is wide open.
Yeah.
Our president comes out and says, yeah, except for Iran chips. We're going to hold off until this whole deal is done. What are you hearing?
Well, it's unbelievable the impact of this naval blockade from Iranian ports. That really seems to be the turning point here. There were moments in this war where I think that people were a little more pessimistic, and now you're seeing just positive news after positive news come out. So it's certainly an optimistic time, and a lot of what the president is saying just in the past couple hours, if it weren't the case, if it actually wasn't true, then it would be so like the opposite of, like he said, that Iran has agreed to never close the Strait of Hormuz again. That's a pretty definitive statement. So if it weren't to be true, it would be easily disprovable, which makes me believe it more. And the fact that it's tied to the Lebanon ceasefire, it seems that he's really putting all the pieces in place for the region to have some stability.
So, yeah, the headline is Tehran opens the Strait of Hormuz, did not deny it. Reuters is saying that. So this morning, the foreign minister came out and said they had somewhat of a hold your horses slant, reported yesterday that Iran has proposed allowing ships to transit on the Omani side only of the strait without interference if the U.S. agrees to conditions that prevent renewed conflict and meet Iran's demands. So that's less than the president says, I got basically everything I want. When we were General Keane this morning, he said he's very read in. Not only does he know a lot of stuff, he actually knows this stuff. He said, we should not give in on any points. That's funding the proxies, no ballistic missile program. I need the 1,000 pounds of uranium out. He calls it nuclear dust, whatever. And you never touch the strait again. So the thing they wouldn't have, they'd stay in power, which makes you wonder when the next eruption is. But if we give in on any of those points, he says it's unnecessary.
Yeah. There was a report from Axios that the United States was considering giving Iran $20 billion to confiscate its nuclear material. And just an hour or so ago, Trump posted on Truth Social saying that no money will be exchanged whatsoever, which I think is yet another reflection of the power dynamic and how it's changed with the blockade and just how Iran really needs that. Their entire economy, 90% of it is from seaborne trade. So it really seems to be a much more effective tactic than the first month of the war where the U.S. just bombed everywhere and took mm-hmm. out so much of the military infrastructure and production capacity within Iran. But this blockade really appears to have the regime at the negotiating table in a way that they weren't before.
So I want you to hear what Lindsey Graham, who also is very well read in, cut five.
As to what happens next, if we can get the 900 pounds of highly enriched uranium and we can open the Straits of Hormuz, that'd be a huge success. President Trump's blockade has been brilliant, and we need to end this well. But they cannot enrich, they cannot be given that right, no matter how long they promise to delay, because they cheat. So I sit here tonight knowing that President Trump is actually the captain of the ship. He's directly involved in negotiations, and I think he's the right man at the right time to end this well. As to terms of a peace deal with Iran, be careful. We don't want a peace in our time moment with people you can't trust.
So they also, in the Reuters report, said, hey, we'll take it, but we'll downblend it. It's not going to work because that means you're still enriching. You remember in the JCPOA, Nate, that they said you can still enrich, but about 1.5%, but you still have all the facilities there and we'll be able to monitor it. But not with people, with cameras.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be with Americans of the West. It's going to be with members of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They're going to be the ones going in. So it wasn't going to be American eyes on it. It was going to be cameras on it. And we didn't know if I had identified all the nuclear facilities.
Yeah.
With the Israeli intelligence and with our intelligence and what we hit and how they've acted, I sense we have a much more confidence that we know all of their nuclear facilities.
Yeah. Yeah. Trump said we're going to collect all the nuclear dust. And I think that you obviously can't trust the Iranians. They've made that pretty clear since the JCPOA. And there was the reporting yesterday that with the vice president's negotiations over the weekend that the administration was possibly considering a 20-year period where Iran wouldn't pursue nukes. But Trump, again, came out and said, no, this is going to be a permanent deal, which backs up sort of his motive for the entire war, which if he can pull that off, another thing to watch would be Iran has made their position. Again, it seems that the power dynamics are shifting in the U.S.'s favor, but Iran's initial position was also that the U.S. was going to have to leave the region. And with many of the U.S. allies being upset, you know, not that that ever appeared to be happening, but it is another indication that President Trump has really flipped this power dynamic with this naval blockade, where I haven't seen any reports of any major concessions that I can even anticipate.
I know. I'm looking everywhere
at this point. So I'm looking, because it's almost like too good to be true right now. So I'm looking for these reports to see what exactly it is that we're going to have to give up, if anything.
And this is what throws me. By the way, this is what General Keane said about extending the ceasefire. Cut nine.
And we should not extend the ceasefire deadline. That gives us the muscle to get them right now in the next few days to admit that they're going to give us everything that we need to do to put this to an end once and for all.
So don't extend the deadline past Tuesday. But this is what worries me. They have the Speaker of the House in a House of Lords type role. The Speaker of the Parliament really have no role. It was all the Ayatollah and the IRGC. But this Speaker was once best friends with Soleimani. They grew up together, and he's in the meeting. Vice President said to Bret Baier, I'm not sure I was in a meeting with people that can make the decision. So whatever I was asking them, it became clear that they weren't making the final decision. So the question is, right now, that guy is back in talking to the Pakistanis. And I assume we're talking to. We don't know exactly who the president's talking to. But if we are, again, dealing with somebody and the military is different from the government, are we cutting a deal with the wrong people? That's what I worry about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the entire leadership structure within Iran is pretty murky at this point.
And it's our fault. us and the Israelis' fault. Take full credit.
Mujtaba Khamenei was putting out all those statements that were read on state TV when he was the new Supreme Leader. So, it's difficult to understand exactly who's making the decisions. Another interesting dynamic here is that Pakistan has a joint defense agreement with the Saudis, and the Saudis were getting bombed a lot for a while. They were talking about possibly entering the war. So I always thought that was an interesting dynamic, which actually hasn't really come to fruition, thankfully. But I mean, Trump just posted a few hours ago thanking Pakistan, saying they're doing a great job mediating the talks. And with all the information that's coming out, it appears that they're making progress at the very least, and that Trump is very hopeful and sort of seems to expect a deal, I don't want to say imminently, but pretty soon.
So I want to talk about these missing scientists. I imagine you're going to be on this at some point. I thought, okay, this is a one-day story. Someone's going to say coincidence, and it's going to be some A&E special, but it is real. And we're missing at least 10 scientists over the last 2.5 years, many of which are some of the smartest people in our country. I mean, we have this Monica Jacinto Reza, vanished while hiking, unclear on the circumstances. William McCaslin, disappeared in February, had deep ties to the Air Force Research Group. We have this guy, Michael David Hicks, a longtime JPL scientist involved in asteroid and comet research, died under mysterious conditions in 2023. You have one story after another. And then when the president's asked about it, you expect him to say, well, there's no big deal, or that's not the truth. Instead, he says this. Cut 32.
There are these 10 missing scientists with access to classified stuff, nuclear material, aerospace. They've all gone missing or turned up dead in the last couple months. Based on what you've been briefed, what do you think is happening here? And do you think that this is connected or totally random?
Well, I hope it's random, but we're going to know in the next week and a half. I just left a meeting on that subject, so pretty serious stuff. But we're going to be now. Hopefully, I don't know, coincidence, if you whatever you want to call it. But some of them were very important people, and we're going to look at it over the next session.
That's not going to make this go away.
In journalism and national security, you're not allowed to believe in coincidences, especially when it's so many and such smart people dying in such mysterious ways with, you know, the motivation of possibly foreign nations trying to diminish the progress that we're making in these, you know, military pursuits, these aerospace research pursuits. So I appreciate the transparency from the administration in the fact that, you know, Peter asked that question first in the White House press briefing, I think 2 days ago, and then he asked the president yesterday. I believe Trump said that we're going to get an answer in the next week or so. He said he was just briefed on it. So definitely legit questions being asked about this.
This guy, Stephen Garcia, a government contractor who disappeared on August 28th, is among the 10 scientists, sparking concern. He worked at the Kansas City National Security Campus over in Albuquerque. Others who have been impacted, including Frank Maywood, who died without a public cause, and the mystery disappearance of Los Alamos National Laboratory staffer Anthony Chavez. So one after another. What I always wanted, Nate, just if someone in my family especially a prominent person, disappeared, committed suicide, walked, went on a hike, never came back, left the phone behind. I mean, why wouldn't I call a press conference?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't I make a big deal? Hey, Fox News, I don't know if you know it, but I have my brother was an elite scientist. We don't know where he is. He talked about being, one of these guys talked about being followed.
Yeah.
So where are those families? Where are these 10 families?
Yeah, one of them was talking about having brain fog as well, just sort of strange symptoms beforehand. Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say. I was watching Will Cain's show yesterday. He said that he referenced some families were concerned. I had seen another report where the wife of one of these missing men had sort of said, you know, these classified secrets are pretty old, and I don't think that anything would happen because of the projects that he worked on. So you're sort of hearing both, but I'm with you.
Wouldn't you? Obviously. In your family? You know,
and not, this is a different story, but it kind of reminds, it's rare that there's a media report where then the government says, we have no idea.
Yeah.
We're going to look into it. It kind of reminds me of the New Jersey drones.
Oh, yeah. Where'd that go?
You know, where Biden came out, he's like, I don't know.
Yeah,
and I was covering that, and every day people were like, Nate, what have you learned? And I was like, I'm getting nothing.
Right. So here's Congressman Eric Burleson, who's leading the investigation in the House. And guess what? We got Democrats and Republicans working together. Cut 35.
What's really disturbing when you look back and you reflect on it, you've got Monica Reza, you've got Anthony Chavez, you've got Melissa Cassius, and you have Stephen Garcia, all of which, along with General McCaslin, walked out of their homes, or in the case of Mrs. Reza, she disappeared on a hike without their phones. They just literally disappeared, left all of their devices at home. This is not normal. These are some of the most advanced scientists, researchers in our nation, some of the most important people for nation's national security efforts, and they all just mysteriously disappeared.
In pretty short order, too.
Yes.
And this is happening recently. You know, one of the guys passed away or went missing in late February.
Yeah.
So, this is recent.
And there's a 59-year-old who died under mysterious circumstances in 2023, a scientist. But that's as far back as it goes. But now there's a pattern. We got to look into it. Hopefully we can rally around that. You know, look, the Israelis were killing nuclear scientists in Iran, anything to stop that program, because no one believed the Israelis when they were saying the Iranians are lying to you. They are developing nuclear weapons. The West was saying, oh, not really. We're watching them. And then the MEK, an outlaw group outside Iran, says, no, there's another facility. And they exposed the Fordo facility. So then the Iranians took things into their own hands. They decided, I'll just kill the people that are making the nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
So maybe they're taking a page from what the Iranians are doing. I hope not. But this is going to, we got to get to the bottom of that.
It would be disturbing if that's what's happening and our government doesn't know about it yet.
Right. Now, who is it like? I know that Carly's a handful to work with. Is it as troublesome as you thought?
She is so lovely.
Right.
She is just the absolute best. I love working with her. Love hanging out with her.
So you can't even be sarcastic and have fun. You just, because you like her that much.
I like her that much. Well, you have fake work friends, you know, stuff like that. She seems just like one of the best people that I've met.
And can I just say this unofficially? You two together have the longest man and woman torsos in television news. Do you think that
we'd
could
be good
right?
Swimmers.
Do you stand at 6'7", 6'8"?
Between the two. Six, seven and a half.
6'7" and a half. And your brother's taller?
I'm the tallest, but in a fight to the death, I would come in third.
You would?
My two older brothers are just humongous people. Like, they're 6'4 and 6'5". But they're heavier than me, but not unathletic. They're strong and athletic,
heavy. Pretty athletic family, safe to say?
My father was the captain of the Boston College basketball team, and somehow he produced four sons, 6'4 and above, and my 6'5 brother played hockey very briefly, but not Division I, and nobody made Division I. We let everyone down. Everyone in my town was like, oh, the Foys are totally going to produce at least one, two, maybe three D1 athletes, and we got none.
I'm pretty sure they're pretty happy with what you've got, all you guys have become, especially you, Nate.
They're very proud of my brothers.
Great to see you. And you got the coveted spot on the 21st floor right next to my office. So everybody wanted that office.
Well, as you know, I get free concerts every once in a while, whenever Alexa decides to listen to you on the TV.
Once in a while, that happens. Brian Kilmeade Show. Thanks, Nate.
Thank you.
Illuminating, intriguing, inculcating.
I know some of these words.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Did President Trump approve your decision to end CDC's pro-vaccine public messaging?
Well, I mean, there's a global measles epidemic. We've done better in preventing it than any country in the world.
There is no country that has seen a bigger percentage increase.
That's not true. Mexico has three times our measles, and they have one-eighth of our population.
You suspended this pro-vaccine messaging campaign, but somehow you're spending taxpayer dollars to drink milk shirtless in a hot tub with Kid Rock.
What's wrong with you? It's called a way to sell the story. Number two is, I don't know about the vaccines, but why didn't she acknowledge what he just said about Mexico? And the person that they're, you know, the vaccine issue is a real issue. And we can go back and forth with that, not equipped to answer that or debate that. But I think that people asking questions is a real good start. And doctors being pressed not to give kids 26 shots in the hours after they're born is also something I think people should have a say in. And I think it's all in a positive light. Just keep in mind, coming up on One Nation, I'll be talking the MAHA movement Sunday at 10 o'clock Eastern time with Gary Brecka. He's somebody who helps, a great friend of RFK. Also, Rick Caruso, to break down what's happening in Los Angeles. Remember the unbelievably successful billionaire who ran for mayor and should have beat Karen Bass, and people want him to run for governor. What's going on in California? I had a chance to meet him at the Al Smith dinner. Also coming up on that show, David Petraeus is going to bring us up to date on what's happening with the war. Is anybody better? Maybe General Keane, who mentored him. And we're going to have Tim Ricketts on, owner of the Cubs, and talk about raising money for the midterms, because he was heading up Donald Trump's fundraising committee, a big success story. All right, Sunday at 10, and to BrianKilmeade.com for all my live shows.